crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nuktikal, coming to you today from Jerusalem, Israel. Thank you very much for your feedback on the programs and also your feedback on the website articles. That's coming in via Facebook or direct to the website through your comments or even the emails to letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. Appreciate those. Thanks very much to Christopher Eames for taking last week's program. There is still some renovations taking place here in our office in Jerusalem, although most of the workers have gone home a couple of minutes ago, leaving me to do today's program. One of our best articles so far, at least getting the most traffic over the past couple of months, is an article by Christopher Eames on the website about King Hezekiah. I would recommend that you would go back and read that, detailing the convergence between the Bible and archaeology from that time period. It's had over 3,000 reads. It's been shared about 844 times on Facebook, as per the last time I checked earlier. So it's doing quite well. It's being shared quite a lot, especially in Israel. Most of our traffic does come from Israel. His other three articles that he's written about the lives of King David, the prophet Elisha, and Jeremiah, they're also performing very well on the website. So please go ahead and check those out. A lot of effort goes into writing them, and they will just really elucidate those periods from the Bible and those biblical figures and show you just what exists already discovered in archaeology. Of course, there's so much more to be discovered. Only small portions of this land of Canaan, the area of Palestine or Israel today, has been actually excavated. We tend to think of this area being one of the most heavily excavated places in the world, and indeed it is. And yet, if you look at the total land having been excavated, or even the total area of a tell or an ancient city that's excavated, that isn't that much. It's probably about 10 to 15% generally of sites actually get excavated. So it's amazing what has been found, considering how little excavation has taken place. So as I said, it is just very exciting to see the growth of the website and this program as well, especially with our Israeli audience. And I'd just like to encourage you to go ahead and check in with the website daily if you can. We like to update the website every single day, so there'll generally be an article there or a podcast or webcast, something like this, for you to check into and listen to or read. Today, I'd like to introduce the topic by talking about the Great American Eclipse that is happening on Monday, because eclipses have impacted actually our study of the Bible and archaeology in a dramatic way. And to cover this, I want to quote from Dr. Carl Rasmussen. He's a famous blogger, biblical archaeology blogger online. And he posted an article a couple of days ago entitled "A Solar Eclipse and Old Testament Chronology." And this is what he writes. I think you'll find it very interesting, as I did when I read through this, since it's in the news quite a lot right now. He writes, "Here in the United States, there is much excitement about the total solar eclipse that will take place on August 21st, 2017. But did you know that the solar eclipse of June 15th, 763 BCE holds the key to the chronology of the Old Testament, or the Hebrew Bible? Did you know that it was actually an eclipse that took place back in 963 BCE that actually holds the key to understanding the chronological events of the chronology of events in the Bible?" He said, "Have you ever thought about how a study Bible can, such as, date the rule of Solomon from 970 BC to 930 BC, or simply the dates of the rule of any other biblical king? How do we get those dates? How do we get those dates that we talk about so often?" He says, "This is a complicated topic because the Bible itself does not give exact dates. It doesn't give such dates. Typically, we find in the Bible relative dates, such as In the fourth year of his reign, King Solomon began to build the temple. That's what it says, of course, in 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 1. But when exactly is the fourth year of Solomon? And now some scholars at that point, they have suggested 966 BC or 976, I think he should be writing, BC there. No, he's right, sorry, 966, he's right, BC. But how do they know that? How do we get those dates? Basically, he writes, it's because scholars such as Edwin R. Thiel, and he's the one that did quite a lot of, his chronology is what is used generally in archaeology. It may be off a little bit, but not too much. He writes, such scholars have been able to link the relative chronology given in the Bible to known dates from Assyrian records, Babylonian and Egyptian records, of course, as well. But how do they know that the dates of the Assyrian rulers, of the dates of the Assyrian rulers and events? So that's what we have in the Bible. We have relative chronology of these kings, regnal years, the years this king reigned and this king reigned. And it's by matching those reigns, the reigns of some kings as they turn up on Assyrian records, that we can get a more precise date for the events in the Bible. Then he says again, but how do we know the dates of the Assyrian rulers and events? He says, well, I'm glad you asked. It's because the Assyrians named their years after various officials, including the king. Such a person was called Limmu. He says, don't ask, just trust me. The Assyrians would then, in other documents, date an event such as an invasion, a battle, or the building of a temple, etc., by the name of the Limmu in which it occurred. It is fortunate that there are actually lists of Limmus that can be joined to give a complete sequence from roughly 891 BCE to 648 BCE. So over 200 years, Assyrian documents, they have a great sequence of these Limmus, or these kind of regnal years, if you like. They're dates, not absolute dates, but they are relative chronology, meaning one date goes on to the next, this many years and this many years and this many years. So then he writes, but what we end up with is a sequence of Limmus giving us relative dates, this Limmu before that Limmu. Then he says, how is it possible to turn this long sequence of relative dates, like we have in the Bible, to absolute dates? Well, he writes, some astronomical phenomena are tied to various Limmus. And then he's going to quote from Thiel himself. He says, one item of unusual importance is a notice of an eclipse of the sun that took place in the month of Simanu in the Limmu of Bur-Sagale, who was the name of a person back then. And then he says, astronomical computation has fixed this as June 15, 1963, with the year of the Limmu of Bur-Sagale fixed at 763 BC, the year of every other name of that complete canon can likewise be fixed. The Assyrian list extant today provide a reliable record of the annual Limmu officials from 891 to 648 BC, and for this period, they can provide relative dates in Assyrian history. So that's how we can match up, or we can give a date to an event in the Bible, such as when Solomon started making the temple or building the temple, because we look at some of these relationships between the Assyrian kings, such as some we'll cover today, of Tiglath-Pileser, and him talking about different Israelite kings. And we can obviously say that the Assyrian king, he lived at the same time as a certain Israelite king. And then by working out the chronology of the regnal years of the Israelite kings from that fixed date that the Assyrian period gives us, then we can get a date for the biblical happening. So kind of cool to know that it was the solar eclipse back in 763 BC that played a huge role in helping us determine biblical chronology. And again, biblical chronology is extremely important. the dates of when something happened as extremely important. So while this current eclipse doesn't have any biblical connection necessarily, the one in the past that took place in 763 is very important because it helps us date biblical events, which does actually impact biblical prophecies as we can understand them today. For example, from that date, we can understand the actual date, the year that ancient Israel went into captivity, which is extremely important prophetically. Because if we know that date, the specific year that ancient Israel went into captivity, then we know the starting point of some critical prophecies that help us identify who modern day Israel is today. That's right, modern Israel, the Israel from the Bible, has descendants, and those descendants make up nations today. And we can understand who they are by looking into the Bible and understanding some critical prophecies that have everything to do with certain dates. And the date that I'm referring to specifically is this time period that ancient Israel went into captivity. Now, if you'd like to understand a little bit more about that and to prove to yourself that the ancient nation of Israel is not the modern state of Israel today, then I suggest you go back and listen to our program, Who Are the Modern Descendants of the Ancient Israelites? It has about 1,000 listens on SoundCloud. It's one of our most popular tracks. Now, when we come back, I'm going to actually address some feedback that I actually received recently about this subject of who the modern Israelites are today, not the nation of Israel, who the other tribes are today. The lost 10 tribes and which nations they comprise. Because even though they were once lost, those nations, most of them have been found. And it's critical that you understand who they are today, or it's actually impossible for you to understand most of biblical prophecy. Now, this isn't some weird belief. It's documentable. It's quantifiable. And most importantly, when you have the knowledge of who the modern nations of Israel are, it'll actually open to you the understanding of a full third of your Bible, which is prophecy. So we're going to take a short break. Don't go away.
This is Watch Jerusalem on kpcg.fm. Is prophecy real? Is it anything more than a collection of imaginations, vagaries, and wishful thinking? The answer is no. Human beings have never dreamed up an authentic prediction of the future. The human mind simply isn't capable of it. Such a feat would require godlike power. What about Bible prophecy? Is Bible prophecy real? Is it different than the litany of other failed prophecies that have been discarded throughout human history? Unlike other books, particularly those books that claim to predict the future, the Bible has endured for thousands of years. Something about this book has transcended thousands of generations of human history. And this book, the Holy Bible, claims to predict the future. It claims its prophecies come not from the minds of human beings, but from the mind of their Creator, from the mind of God. Prove the Bible's prophecies for yourself. If you cannot honestly prove them to be true, discard the Bible and move on with your life. But if you can, what a spectacular book the Bible becomes. Request Herbert W. Armstrong's free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book will examine the core Bible prophecies and compare them to history and current events. More than 6 million people have requested this amazing and easy-to-read book. Order The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong and prove Bible prophecy for yourself. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. This is Watch Jerusalem on kpcg.fm.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm Brent Nachtigall. We're talking about ancient Israel and the modern nations of Israel today. Earlier this morning, I received an email from a man that took to task our identification of the Lost Ten Tribes. But before I get into his email and just addressing some of his issues, which I understand he has, and I don't necessarily fault him for that. It's good to see that somebody is thinking about these things. But before we get into that, we need to go over some background. Most people are familiar with the term 12 Tribes of Israel. Those are the 12 sons of Jacob, whose name later became Israel. And they were Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher. They were the 12 sons. Now, when the Israelites arrived in the Promised Land under Joshua, each tribe was given its own district or territorial holding, except for the priestly tribe of Levi. They were mainly mingled among the tribes in different cities. But also at that point, or even before that point, Joseph himself, he had been separated into two tribes, the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, and they were both Joseph's sons, as we would talk about later. Both of them were each assigned their own district. So technically there were 13 tribes, but 12 districts, if you like, or 12 territories for each of those tribes. Except for Levi, most of these tribes kind of kept to themselves. They were united as one nation under Saul, and then they broke apart for a while, and then under David and Solomon, they were one nation, the nation of Israel, much like the 50 states, if you like, in America. Now, Israel reached its height, as we've covered on this program, as an empire during the reign of King David and Solomon. When they were united, when they were together, that's when they were most strong. But because of a lot of Solomon's sins, God said in 1 Kings chapter 11 that he was going to rend the kingdom from him. God also promised that there would be a tribe preserved for David, for the sake that David received a promise from God that his son was always going to be on the throne. The scepter promise that was given to the tribe of Judah would play out through David's lineage. So that was going to be a tribe or a couple of tribes that were going to stay with David eventually. But the rest of the tribes of Israel broke off. The rest of the tribes of Israel broke off from David. And they continued in with a kingdom in the north, that kingdom being Israel, the kingdom of Israel. So at that point, right after King Solomon, you'd had two separate nations. You had Israel in the north and Judah in the south. They dwelt in separate yet adjoining territories. Each had different kings. Of course, you probably know all this, but it's important to go through it right here at the beginning. Now, as soon as Jeroboam, who was that first king of the northern tribes of Israel, those 10 tribes that went with him, as soon as he became king, he rejected, of course, God's holy days. He rejected the Sabbath. He introduced idol worship back to the nation. And this continued over many different generations. There were plenty of prophets that were sent to this northern kingdom of 10 tribes by God, warning them to return to the way that it was under King David, and yet they never did. So God promised that he was going to root up Israel out of the land, and he was going to scatter them abroad. All over the face of the earth. You can see this in 1 Kings chapter 14 and verse 15. Now, who would God use to do this? He would use the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrian Empire, who had this this system worked out that we can get absolute dating from because of that solar eclipse that took place in the 8th century earlier. Well, in the mid-8th century, so around 750, plus probably a couple of years, the one Assyrian king nicknamed Pul, who was Tiglath-Pileser III, he came down to Israel, the northern tribes, and started taking tribes into captivity. Then Shalmaneser came, and then Sargon came, and they eventually, once you get to 718 BC, all the tribes of Israel, again, the northern tribes of Israel, the southern kingdom wasn't called Israel, those 10 tribes of Israel, they went into captivity. Now, if you continue reading in 2 Kings through this history, following Israel's captivity, you'll see that God warned to the Jewish nation, that is, Jew being a short for Judah, or a nickname of Judah, the Jewish nation, God promised that he would actually remove them out of his sight as well as he removed Israel. and that would eventually happen about 100 years later, but Judah would go into captivity to the Babylonians, not the Assyrians. Then, 70 years after that, the southern kingdom, or the kingdom of the Jews, the kingdom of Judah, they returned back to the area of Palestine, back to this area of Canaan, back to where they lived before, and they called themselves Israel. No, they didn't. No, they didn't call themselves Israel. They called themselves Judah, or Yehud, because they knew who they were. They knew they weren't Israel. Sure, yes, they were sons of Israel, sons of Jacob, but they were the kingdom of Judah. And that's what they were known by ever since, going back even into David's time. Those southern tribes were named after Judah. And so they went back and they had the name Yehud or Judah from that point forward. The actual descendants of the northern tribes of Israel, or basically you could just call them Israel, they never returned to Palestine. Now, if you talk to a rabbi a knowledgeable rabbi, they all understand this. They understand that the people that came back during the time of the Persian Empire, under Zerubbabel, then under Ezra, Nehemiah, all the people that came back could only have come back out of those southern, the tribes that went into captivity to the Babylonians. And they were the tribes of Judah, Benjamin, and Levi. They came back. So if we're talking about the modern state of Israel or the Jews, they don't make up the ancient Israelites, or at least the ancient kingdom of Israel after the division took place. They make up the kingdom of Judah. So what happened to those northern tribes? And that's where we get the term the Lost Ten Tribes. They were completely removed from their land from 721 to 718 BC, and they lost their identity. But they didn't disappear. They weren't wiped off the face of the earth. Now, Werner Keller gives a great account of Israel's separation into two kingdoms in his astounding book that it really helped archaeology and biblical archaeology come to life in the 60s when it was written, The Bible as History. Yet even he writes or makes the same mistake as so many others do. He said this, quote, "The people of the northern kingdom and their kings with them have disappeared. They were absorbed into the population of these foreign lands and never emerged again in history. All investigation into what became of the ten tribes who had their home there has so far come to nothing." So he says, we've studied into this. We can't find these ten tribes anywhere. And you know what? It is very difficult, or it would have been very difficult a couple hundred years ago to identify where these tribes went and which modern peoples make up the northern tribes today. If you believe that God has prophecies for this time we're living in right now, then you'll know that most of them affect this group of people called Israel. When Judah is mentioned in prophecy, then it's about the modern state of Israel. But the modern state of Israel, again, doesn't make up the Lost Ten Tribes. So where are they? They have to exist. Now, you can study Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States in Britain in Prophecy, and you can understand where those tribes went, who they make up, and that information is very critical for you to understand where we are in Bible prophecy. It'll also make sure you're not hoodwinked by foolish interpretations of prophecy as well. So please request that booklet, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. But there is also a critical part of this that we need to understand. And that is that even though all the northern tribes make up the nation of Israel, there are only two tribes in particular that claim the name Israel in prophecy today. Two of those northern ten tribes. And this is explained in the book of Genesis. In the few last chapters of the book of Genesis, you have Jacob, or Israel, getting old, and it's time to confer blessings upon his sons. Of course, they became the 12 tribes. But there was one tribe or one son that was going to receive extra special favor. 1 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 1 and 2, it talks about two special blessings. There was one, that the scepter or the rulership of the nation, that was to go to the tribe of Judah. And that would happen, right, underneath the kingly line of David, who was of the tribe of Judah. However, the birthright promise was to go to Joseph. And the birthright, of course, meant the largest of the physical possessions would be given to him. Now, this is very unusual. Very unusual. Normally, the birthright and the leadership would go to the same son, typically the oldest. Reuben, he was the oldest son, he disqualified himself from that position, and God directed Judah to be chosen to receive the leadership and Joseph the birthright. Now, interestingly enough, this actually created... Well, because of this, there was quite a lot of enmity and jealousy between Joseph, the tribes of Joseph, and also Judah. They both vied for leadership over the whole 12 tribes, but that enmity will eventually be healed. God even draws attention to it in the Bible. However, while in Egypt, of course, remember the Israelites were in Egypt for a time. They went down there as Joseph was there and during that bad famine. And while in Egypt, Joseph had two sons with the anglicized names of Ephraim and Manasseh. That's who we know them by as today. And I just want to read a portion of the Bible here at the end of the book of Genesis, because it shows who Israel is in Bible prophecy, or who that name would be attached to. And this is... I believe it's in Genesis chapter 48. It says this, "And Joseph said unto his father, They are my sons." He's before Jacob or Israel. He's got his two sons there who are actually grown up right now. And he's bringing them towards Israel before he dies. And he's quite blind right now, Israel is. He says, "These are my sons whom God has given me here." And he said, "Bring them, I pray you, unto me, and I will bless them." Now the eyes of Israel were dim for age, so that he could not see. And he brought them near unto him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said unto Joseph, "I had not thought to see your face, and lo, God has let me see your seed also." And Joseph brought them out from between his knees meaning Israel's knees, because they were kneeled before the patriarch Israel. And he fell down upon his face to the earth, and Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand towards Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near unto him. And Israel, the patriarch sitting on the bed now, stretched out his right hand and laid it upon Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand upon Manasseh's head, guiding his hands wittingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, "The God before my fathers, whom my fathers Abraham, Isaac did walk, the God who has been my shepherd all my life, long until this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all the evil, bless the lads," these two lads, "bless these two lads. Let my name," which is Israel, "let my name Israel be named in them, and the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of this earth." So notice what happened there. We'll talk about that a bit later. "And when Joseph saw that his father was laying his right hand upon the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. And he held up his father's hands to remove it from Ephraim's head unto Manasseh's head. And Joseph said unto his father, Not so, my father, for this is the firstborn. Put your right hand upon his head," Manasseh's head. And his father refused, Israel refused, and says, "I know it, my son, Joseph, I know it. He shall also become a people, and he shall be great. Manasseh is going to be great, howbeit his younger son shall be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations." That's the end of the quote there. So here we have two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. They were to get the full portion of the birthright of Israel, and Israel's name would be on them. Again, go to the book of Chronicles. It clears this up. Who got the birthright? The birthright didn't go to all the tribes of Israel. It went to Joseph, and it went to his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Ephraim receiving even the greater portion of that birthright. Manasseh, of course, becoming a great, great nation as well. Now, clearly, this is indicating that while all the tribes of Israel are technically part of Israel, it was only these two sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, that would receive the full prophesied promises. Notice one of them, to become a great people, the other, a multitude of nations. Now, the United States and Britain in prophecies I talked about earlier, that goes into great detail and length to prove to you that these two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, are the British Commonwealth and the United States of America. That's who they are. That's who they are today. And if you want to prove that more diligently, you can go ahead, of course, and read that book as I request of you. Now I'm going to get to this email that I received today, because it refers to this prophecy. It refers to the truth that the United States and Britain are Ephraim and Manasseh, and this email goes to great lengths to try and disprove this. And I'm just going to address this quickly, because you may have some of the same thoughts as this man about United States and Britain making up these end time nations of Israel, the nations that received the birthright, Ephraim and Manasseh in particular. And that's what this man had a problem with. He says this: Ephraim and Manasseh, well, basically his first point in this email was that Ephraim and Manasseh were more than likely black because of Joseph's wife was Egyptian and ancient Egyptians are black. So he's saying it couldn't be Ephraim and Manasseh because Ephraim and Manasseh were black, because Egyptians were black and Joseph's wife was Egyptian. Now, he is right. Ancient Egyptians were definitely black. And it is true that Asenath, Joseph's wife, was from the area of Egypt. She was from Potipharah, one of the families of On. Now, the Bible does refer to the family that she came from specifically, which might give indication that she wasn't a typical Egyptian. But nevertheless, let's just say for argument's sake that she is black, or that she was black. He says that would make the children, well, that would make the children of Ephraim and Manasseh half black. However, from that point on, Ephraim and Manasseh, they would have married into the Israelite stock. So even if they were half black initially, they would have lived together with the other Israelites, 12 tribes of Israelites, in the area of Goshen in northern Egypt. Then they went into the wilderness for 40 years. Then they went into the promised land where they were commanded to marry within the nation. Now, I say this because this means that that initial bit of half-blackness that Ephraim and Manasseh might have had would have been bred out within a couple of generations, for sure. Now, again, I'm referring to this because this man believes that Ephraim and Manasseh should make up, should be black nations today, just because Joseph's wife was an Egyptian, which, I mean, you can disprove that that has to be that would be the case pretty quick. Anyhow, he says this. This is his point number two. He says, in Jacob's day, the patriarch was, at a very, very conservative estimate, one man in a world population of at least 6 million. The world's population in Jacob's day may have been more or less greater than that, but for the purpose of this discussion, we'll say Jacob was one in 6 million people on Earth. The present combined population of the alleged British Israelite nations, Britain, meaning Ephraim, the United States, and Canada, Australia, and so on and so forth, other Western European nations, he puts at 1 billion. And then he says the approximate 1/7 of the world's present population is 7 billion. So he's saying that basically it started with one man, which is Jacob, when the population of the earth was 6 million. Now, the world's population is 7 billion, and you're telling me, he's saying to us, that 1 billion of those are actually sons of Jacob, that are sons of Israel? Now, I'm not going to spend too much time on this, because I believe while Jacob did start with one man, by the time they came out of Egypt, there were multiple millions. There were multiple millions of people making up the Israelite stock. And let's just say for argument's sake that there were 1 million Israelites that came out of Egypt, a growth rate that is definitely possible through the 400 or a bit under that, the years that they were down there. The Bible blatantly says in the first chapter of the book of Exodus that the Israelites multiplied rapidly. So rapidly to the point that they will equal with the Egyptian population. Israel's growth rate and population size is actually what triggered the Egyptian leadership to make them into slaves. So around the time that Israel was coming out of Egypt, the general estimate is that there were about 50 million people on earth. So that's not bad. That's 1 in 50 people. That is in around 1500 BC, would have been an Israelite. Not 6 million people. So we're going back 3,500 years, and now we're 1 in 50 as an Israelite. So that 1 in 7 isn't looking that bad. Nevertheless, it's also important to look at what God actually prophesied of the nations of Israel. God actually prophesied that they would be massive in this end time. Now, I want you to notice this. This is from Genesis chapter 22 and verse 17. This is what God said to Abraham about the birthright blessing. The birthright blessing that was passed down from Abraham to Isaac, to Jacob, to Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, as we learned from 1 Chronicles chapter 5, and a birthright that they, the ancient nation of Ephraim and Manasseh, or the tribes of ancient Ephraim and Manasseh, never actually received because of their rebellion. But it was going to be finally bestowed in our day upon the modern descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh. This is what God said then of modern Israel. Modern Israel was to be like this, that in blessing I will bless you, in multiplying I will multiply your seed as the stars of heaven and as the sand which is upon the sea shore. So part of the birthright blessing itself was shocking growth, absolutely shocking population growth. So the fact that he's talking about it starting with one man and growing into around a billion, it's probably a little bit less than that, around a billion today, that actually fits quite well with the prophecy. That could even be a proof of who modern Israel is today. Anyway, the one final thing he says of why ancient Israel, or the modern nations of Israel, the modern nations, sorry, of Ephraim and Manasseh, do not make up ancient Israel, the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. He says that when Israel was scattered around the world, the language its people spoke was basically Hebrew or Aramaic, and none of the modern nations of Israel speak Hebrew today. They simply lost that language and took upon themselves new languages. So he's saying that's a point. We have all these people, apparently, that we say were scattered abroad. None of them speak Hebrew anymore. Why don't they speak Hebrew? Well, I'm not going to go into this one too deeply. It seems pretty obvious that when the Israelites went into captivity with the Assyrians, without the priestly class of the Levites, who were the ones responsible for preserving the text of the Bible, the ones that had the written records, of course, being in Hebrew, of course they would lose their language as they quickly strove to assimilate into the populations in which they were put. Losing the language of Hebrew would have happened naturally. They would have lost their language quickly, just as they lost any vestige of the fact that they were Israelite. They lost their religious beliefs even. That would have separated from the nations. But they lost their language quickly, and they lost their religious belief quickly, which is why their identity was hidden for so long. They didn't have those things. Now, he's probably saying that because we have the Jewish nation. They speak Hebrew today. Well, the conditions of the Jewish captivity were totally different to the Assyrian captivity. The Jews could preserve the Hebrew language partly due to the fact that the priestly Levitical class, they held on to it when they went into captivity. They had the prophetic writers of Jeremiah, Daniel, Ezekiel, Ezra. They were all in that southern kingdom. They all went into Babylonian captivity, or a part of it, and they were still writing in Hebrew. Then once the Persian government, or the Persian Empire, came around, it was actually their public policy to put out decrees in the native tongues of the people that they wrote to. So if they're writing back to Nehemiah, if they're writing back to Ezra or Zerubbabel, they are going to put the decree in Hebrew or in Aramaic. So there would be no reason for the Jews to lose Hebrew at that point. The Persians saw to the revival of the Jewish state where Hebrew and Aramaic were used. And all those conditions were different to what happened with the northern tribes, who always assimilated into the outside, tried to assimilate into outside nations, and who had already changed their religious beliefs under Jeroboam 200 years before they even went into captivity. So the fact that the Israelites, or the modern nations of America or Britain, don't speak Hebrew does not negate the fact that they could be the modern descendants of the ancient tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, I don't really have time to go into more detail than that. I just hope I've just answered some of his queries in his email. I don't blame this man at all for writing this comment. It is hard in some ways to discern who modern Israel is today. They were lost, and in fact, they were actually meant to be lost from history for a time. And now, it was only in the last 100 years that their identity has become known. Now, you can prove this for yourself far better than what I have done just talking about these questions that this man had today. And you can do that, of course, as I mentioned earlier, by requesting Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Join over 5 million others and get this book for free by visiting watchjerusalem.co.il/USBP, if you're listening to this on the radio, or you can click the link on the notes that I leave below the show. Thanks for joining us today. That's all I have time for. I'm Brent Nachtigall. You've been listening to Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive.